Overdose deaths have been rising during COVID. Today, Ashwin Patkar and Richard Weisler share tips on how to reduce the problem in your own practice. Welcome to the Carlette Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor of the Carlette Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. Life expectancy took a hit in 2020. In the US, it dropped a year, from 79 to 78. But this decline started long before COVID. It was in 2015 that the mortal number started to decline for the first time in 100 years. The reason was drug overdoses, particularly from opioids. And those overdoses have risen in lockstep with the COVID crisis this year. Richard Weisler and Ashwin Patkar have been following these trends since the 2000s. Both are practicing psychiatrists. Dr. Weisler runs a general adult outpatient practice, and Dr. Patkar works with a higher-risk population in addiction psychiatry. Both have changed their practices in response to the crisis, and today they're going to share what we can do to reduce the risk of death in the patients we serve.
It's often called the opioid crisis, but that obscures the fact that most of the deaths involved multiple substances, usually sedatives and benzodiazepines. But even stimulants like Adderall and Ritalin can increase the risk of overdose with opioids. So the drugs that we prescribe are part of the problem. Benzos are the riskiest because the way that opioids cause death is through respiratory suppression, and benzos and opioids both suppress respiration in different ways. Benzos do this through the GABA-A inhibition, and opioids suppress breathing in the medulla. The effect is much like a stereo system. Unplug one speaker, and you can still hear the music. Unplug both, and breathing stops.
It's very rare for benzos to cause overdose deaths on their own, but when combined with opioids, they are much more lethal. Alcohol is another one to watch for. It turns down breathing through a mechanism similar to the benzos, and a patient who is drinking a little too much and taking opioids is at high risk for an unintended overdose.
Most of these deaths are unintended, as patients may just take a little extra when their pain is high or they're having a rough day without any idea that it could kill them. So any respiratory suppressant can be a problem with opioids, as can any medication that alters memory, self-control, or consciousness. And this is another reason that benzos are implicated in the problem. Benzos enhance the rewarding effects of opioids in the CNS. And that leads to a somewhat counterintuitive clinical pearl. Benzos are much more dangerous in the hands of someone in recovery from an opioid use disorder than they are in someone who's recovered from alcohol use disorder. We know that from studies that have followed up on these patients long-term and measured both mortality, relapse risk, and other problems when patients with a history of abuse of either opioids or alcohol take benzodiazepines.
But we're not here to scare you out of prescribing controlled substances. There are unintended consequences to that as well that we'll get into today. In fact, you could say this whole crisis was an unintended consequence. One that started in the 1990s when doctors got the idea that pain was undertreated, and many emergency room physicians wore no pain buttons on their white coats.
In the early 90s, there was an emphasis, well-intentioned, to a large extent, of managing pain and considering pain equivalent to the fifth vital sign. So you have to ask for pain and then address it if it was an issue. In 1996, there was a paper published looking at whether or not we are seeing any differences in opioid overdoses as pain was being managed. And at that point, the data did not show that there was a trend. However, in 2000, when they compared opioid overdoses versus 1996, you could already see the change occurring. So the CDC tracks it really to 1999, and that was the first wave of the opioid addiction and overdose epidemic, and that was the prescription opioid overdose death epidemic.
How bad have things gotten during the pandemic?
The best study, actually, that Chris, that came out was last week from Chicago in the latest CDC MMWR reports. And I have some bias towards that since I'm now at Rush University. So they track what was happening before COVID, during COVID, stay at home after COVID, and then stay at home order was lifted. Before December 2019, the deaths, this is in Chicago, Cook County, from opioid overdose was 22 per week. From December to March, it increased to 35 per week. And from March to May, Chicago had stay-at-home order, so people could not leave. As you may expect, that spiked the deaths to around 45. And after that, it was lifted in June, and it declined, but it declined to 32, which is still elevated if you look before what was happening in December, that the rate was 22. So what it tells you a story of during COVID-19, you're seeing an increase in deaths, the social restrictions and associated consequences of COVID, including mental health consequences, spiked the rate. And I suspect even after the social restrictions are lifted, primarily because of the mental health consequences and challenges in terms of access to opioid treatment, you're still going to see an elevated rate compared to what we were seeing before COVID.
Why do you think overdose deaths have risen during the pandemic?
Clearly, a lot of people lost their jobs, you know, almost immediately after it happened in the middle of the spring there. You know, there were massive unemployment, total disruption. All the kids were out of school. It caused a lot of relationship and marital kind of problems, as well as access to treatment problems. And a lot of offices actually closed. A lot of treatment resources closed for people as well. So that compounded the problem very, very significantly. But I think overall, you know, what's clear is that, you know, mood problems, anxiety problems increase separately from even the drug abuse. But a lot of these patients, as we know, will have both those kind of situations and often will have some, you know, family dynamics and situations going on too, or work dynamics with loss of job. Or a lot of people lost family members. You know, anytime we're talking about close to 550,000 deaths in the country now, that's an incredible number from COVID in this time period, a little bit over a year. And a lot of those family members, caregivers, et cetera, even a lot of healthcare providers themselves have been impacted by all that.
There's been a lot of efforts to lower these deaths in the past decade, from education to regulation to declaring it a national emergency. Were we making any progress before COVID?
So the short answer is yes. If you look at the data from 2017 to 2018, we had about a 4.6% reduction in deaths. So I would say that the trend was we were making some headway, and we were optimistic that it would continue till, of course, COVID hit.
What's fueling the rise in these overdose deaths? Is it prescription drugs, or are they getting them on the street?
So today, primarily what you are seeing, the overdose deaths, is in majority of cases, over 50%, is the synthetic opioids, primarily fentanyl and its analogs. We did a study in Raleigh where we found about 50% of patients who were coming in for heroin addiction had synthetic opioids, primarily fentanyl, in their system. Even 25% of those who were coming in with cocaine were having fentanyl in its system.
Now, fentanyl is no longer on the prescription market, right?
No, this is just like essentially illegally manufactured and diverted fentanyl. So this is.
And what happened too, by the way, what people would announce is there would be strong shipment, would be the word going around town coming in, and people would pay more often or have more demand for this stronger stuff. But it would frequently have the fentanyl or often carfentanil in there. And again, carfentanil is 10,000 times stronger. If you mix that in, it's much more potent, and you may get more of a demand for your supply of stuff you're selling illegally.
Part of what is going on here is a tale as old as time. We've solved one problem with a new technology, but the solution has created another problem that might be as bad as the one we started with. The technology is synthetic opioids. Humankind had been using natural opioids from the poppy plant for over 3,000 years when the first industrially produced opioid, morphine, was launched by Merck Pharmaceuticals in 1827. Another invention, the hypodermic needle, caused this drug to really take off in the 1850s, and soon the concern shifted from treating pain to addressing the addiction the opioids were causing. In the 1870s, scientists attempted to modify morphine to create a non-addictive opioid, but they created instead one that was much more potent and rewarding, heroin. Heroin's record was topped in 1959 when Paul Janssen of Janssen Pharmaceuticals developed fentanyl, which is 30 to 50 times more potent than heroin. The company developed carfentanil 15 years later, which is 100 times more potent than fentanyl. Carfentanil was used in veterinary medicine to sedate large animals. It went by the catchy trade name Wildnil. It is no longer on the market, and in fact most manufacturers, including Janssen, have discontinued fentanyl in response to the opioid crisis. But both of these drugs are available on the streets, where their industrial potency contributes to many opioid deaths.
So opioid fatalities are on the rise during the pandemic. What about other drugs?
We have been talking about opioids, but during COVID-19 and in general, even before that, the deaths from cocaine and methamphetamine have also been rising. During COVID, for example, the cocaine deaths went up by 25%. The methamphetamine went up by 35%.
One thing we can do is check the controlled substance database, but I imagine we're not going to catch all of these cases if 50% of the opioids are not coming from a doctor's prescription pad.
Yeah, well, that's a good point you make. So I think controlled substance database is a good tool to do risk stratification. Just like having a comorbid mental health disorder is a good risk stratification. However, you need to go beyond that, particularly if you're addressing people with substance use problems such as opioids, and you're going to need to monitor either through urine or salivary drug screen what really is present. The fact that many of even today's benzodiazepines such as Xanaxes on the street are adulterated with other substances, including fentanyl, should be a cause for concern.
Ashwin, you're an addictionologist, so you come at this crisis with a lot of expertise that other psychiatrists don't have. How should a non-addictionologist adjust their practice in response to the epidemic?
First, have a very low threshold for comorbidity of substance use with mental health disorders, in particular mood disorders, but even anxiety disorders, PTSDs, ADHD. So ask, and after that, trust but verify. So it's a good idea, particularly if you're prescribing controlled substances such as benzodiazepines or stimulants, to check the controlled substance database. Have some collateral information if you can. If somebody's coming in with history that is inconsistent with what their records of controlled substance database shows. And then verify if you need to by getting a urine or salivary drug screen before you consider writing a prescription for a controlled substance. If you do write a prescription, and there are several instances when it is justified, particularly panic disorder, use of benzodiazepines, stimulants for ADHD, please monitor. So I think the biggest issue I see when I see patients coming in to see me is that the patients have not been monitored. So they have been prescribed, but the monitoring is not adequate. And then there's no way of knowing whether they are starting to have problems or risks associated with prescribed controlled substances.
And what do you consider appropriate and inappropriate follow-up with controlled substances like stimulants and benzos?
Adequate monitoring would include if you are prescribing controlled substances that you are seeing them either telehealth or in person at least every 3 months. Ideally sooner, but at least every 3 months to verify. At least a couple of times a year, have a urine drug screen done. We do it much more frequently with the population we see every visit. There is no downside to it, perhaps except the cost. Today, you can get salivary drug screens done easily. So it's not like the burden of having a urine drug screen sample that needs to be handled by your office. Check the controlled substance database system. And if you're finding inconsistencies in what patient is reporting and what you're observing, I think it's always a good idea of collaborating with your colleagues who are in addiction specialty just to see whether, hey, can I quickly run through this by you and see what's going on.
Ashwin and I have had patients before, at least I've had one or two, that actually would bring in their own samples of urine from someone else that they could then substitute. And, you know, I found this out later, and sometimes we would do other tests to try to tease it out. People can be quite adept at hiding this stuff from you.
Should the drug screens be done randomly?
I think you could have it random, or you could have it you know, tomorrow, if you're going to do a saliva drug screen, you can't provide an adulterated sample. I mean, the person is doing it in front of you. The challenge of doing random drug screens are going to be often it's not practical because patients will avoid it.
Could you randomly do the salivary in your office?
Yeah, you could do it randomly. Even if you do it as indicated, it's not like you can avoid giving a saliva sample. You know, as opposed to urine, where you say, I can't pass urine, it's very hard to say that here's the swab in your mouth and you're going to avoid saturating it.
What are some reliable companies that are offering salivary drug screens?
Well, the company we use, which is Radius, I think is very good. The advantage I have with them is they do remote testing for telehealth. So they will arrange either to meet the person in a public place or a drive-through, or if preferred, in the parking lot in their house and get a saliva sample.
Naloxone is an opioid blocker that can be taken intranasally to reverse an opioid overdose. A lot of states are requiring physicians to discuss this rescue medicine or even prescribe it when they are prescribing opioids. Do you think psychiatrists should also prescribe it to at-risk patients, even if we aren't prescribing the opioid?
My answer is yes, psychiatrists should recommend having naloxone. Today, we have a standing order in majority of the states in the country. So you don't even need to prescribe. You simply need to tell the patient, go and pick it up from the pharmacy. Just ask for it. And then the pharmacy generally gives them a DVD to look at in terms of how to use it. Mostly, it's going to be the nasal spray.
Yeah, I would say as well, when you look at the data in the states where it is being used, it saves so many lives.
And I always tell psychiatrists, it doesn't hurt to have one in your own office.
I have worked with other providers of all different types, and they've told me they keep some in their car just because they have seen things like cars stopped on the side of the road or other kind of places and have access to it. It's life-saving. And a lot of the times the people who have had that happen can be motivated to really make a change. Not always, but in most cases they can, I think.
To summarize, you are recommending that we ask about drug use and look for signs of substance abuse, that we check the controlled substance database, educate patients about naloxone, coordinate with other providers who may be prescribing opioids or sedatives, check drug screens on patients when we treat them with controlled substances, and get collateral information from relatives when we're treating patients with controlled substances. I want to focus on that last one, because a lot of patients don't want their relatives involved in their care. And I know that can be a problem because the relative is often the one who notices that they are taking too much of their benzos, getting opioids on the streets, or, for that matter, getting paranoid on Adderall. So are you saying that we might consider not prescribing a benzo or stimulant if the patient refuses to let us check collaterals, just like an endocrinologist might refuse to prescribe insulin if the patient would not allow anyone to check their glucose and other labs?
Chris, I will tell you right off the bat that we have a controlled substance agreement for all controlled drugs, which include automatic consent with a caregiver as well as other providers. So without that, we tell people that we really can't weigh your risks and benefits appropriately. So it's my duty as a physician to make sure that we can weigh the risks and benefits. And for that, we'll require to speak to a family member as well as your other providers. So if that is not signed by you, then we will not be able to really prescribe opioids. So that's the policy we have at our end. Rick,
it's very, very similar. And again, we really need to know, because so often things can change so quickly, and especially if people are mixing in some of these substances we're talking about on top of their very significant mood or anxiety disorders, whatever else may be going on, it's the only way to really help provide care. And again, a lot of times that collaboration with their psychologist or other therapist or primary care doctor is also critical, because we all have to be a team.
The opioid crisis was an unintended consequence of changes made to the treatment of pain in the 1990s. Doctors got too aggressive with it
and the excess use of opioids led to dependence and overdose deaths. But as our conversation wrapped up, Dr. Weisler and Pakhtar suggested that the regulatory initiatives to stop opioids may have unintended consequences of their own. Dr. Pakhtar pointed to evidence that patients turned to illegal drugs like heroin after we clamped down on prescription opioids.
As I mentioned earlier, the prescription opioid epidemic, the first wave started around, you would say, 1999, 2000. And in 2010, so after a decade, you had the heroin epidemic start. So what you started seeing is the efforts of addressing prescription opioids. If you do that without adequately addressing opioid use disorder and its treatment, you're simply going to see a shift from prescription opioids into heroin. And then we had in 2013, what's happening even today, the most concerning, the third wave, which is a synthetic opioid analogs overdose, which is now basically what we are seeing.
And Dr. Weisler mentioned that the opioid withdrawal state itself raises the risk of suicide. The evidence for this is fairly new, so I'll go over it here. There was a large VA study from 2020 that found the risk of suicide rose after opioid withdrawal, and this risk was greater the longer the patient had been on the opioid, from twofold risk after 30 days of treatment to a sevenfold risk after more than a year of opioid use. That study was observational and not controlled, so it doesn't prove causation, but there are other recent studies that point to a similar concern. In a nested case-controlled study of 15,000 patients from Kaiser Permanente, patients were more likely to overdose on opioids when there was high variability in their dosing, such as what happens when practitioners attempt to wean them down. And a Medicaid study from 2 years ago found that the faster the opioid taper, the greater was the risk of overdose. And the patients in this Medicaid study remained at high risk of adverse consequences with opioids even after their prescription was tapered off. 50% of them went to the hospital or emergency room for an opioid-related problem, such as an overdose, even after their prescriptions were stopped. So the bottom line is that these patients need a lot of monitoring, care, and treatment during the opioid withdrawal phase because it's a high risk for suicide and other bad events. Simply yanking them off their opioid doesn't reduce the problem. We need to keep these patients in treatment where their withdrawal problems can be addressed so they don't need to turn to the streets. Managing withdrawal symptoms and weaning medications is as much a science as an art, and we delved into that in our last podcast, which was on tapering benzodiazepines.
Ashwin Pakhtar is Chief of Advanced Psychiatry and Adjunct Professor of Psychiatry at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. Richard Weisler is in private practice in Raleigh, North Carolina, and holds adjunct professorships at UNC Chapel Hill and Duke. Both are active in clinical practice and clinical research, and their paper on opioid deaths can be found in the January 2021 issue of Current Psychiatry. And there's also a link to it in the episode notes and in the text to this podcast, which is online at the Carlet Report. And now, for the word of the day, zopiclone. That's zopiclone, not esopiclone.
The Z-hypnotics are called Z-hypnotics because, well, their generic names all start with the letter Z. There's Zolpidem, Ambien, Zaleplon, Sonata. And wait a minute, esopiclone, Lunesta, that one starts with the letter E. So what's going on here? Esopiclone, Lunesta, is an isomer of the original Z-hypnotic, zopiclone, one that has been used in Europe since 1986, but is not available in the U.S. Like many medications, zopiclone comes as two stereoisomers, which are mirror image left and right hand versions of the same molecule, and S-zopiclone, Lunesta, is the isomer that's responsible for nearly all of zopiclone's therapeutic effects. You see the same relationship with antidepressants like citalopram and S-citalopram. So how did America end up with the S-isomer while Europe got the full racemic mixture? Zopiclone was released in 1986 in Europe, but it was not approved in the U.S. due to concerns that it might cause cancer. Many hypnotics actually have been associated with cancer risk in animal and human studies, but the link has never been proven definitively. 2 years later, the FDA relaxed its view of the cancer risk with hypnotics and approved Zolpidem Ambien, the first Z-hypnotic in America. And by the time the industry was ready to resubmit their Zolpidem data, the medication had already gone generic, but a clever pharmaceutical company, Sepracor, figured it would try its luck with the stereoisomer S-Zolpidem. The gamble worked, and S-Zolpidem was FDA-approved as Lunesta in 2004. Sepracor went one step further and tried to get S-Zolpidem approved in Europe, but the European regulators were not as easily fooled by the stereoisomer shell game. They declared that S-Zolpidem was too similar to Zolpidem. Indeed, it is contained within Zolpidem, and denied it. But are they really that similar? We know of only one controlled study that compared them head-to-head, and it was pretty large, 200 patients. After a month, both drugs had the same clinical effects, the same side effects, and the same benefits. In this month's issue, we feature a study on S-Zolpidem and PTSD, where it didn't work as expected, and in next Monday's podcast, we'll look at whether S-Zolpidem, Lunesta, can augment antidepressants in depression and anxiety disorders.
Follow us on Twitter, where Dr. Aiken is posting a new research study every day. Today's tweet is a randomized control trial of the DASH diet in ADHD. Subscribe online and you'll get a host of CME options and $30 off your first year subscription with the promo code PODCAST. And you'll help us stay on our mission to bring you practical updates without industry influence.